Good evening, everyone. Welcome to Rose City Politics. Tonight is November the 3rd. Our regular panel includes Doug Sartori and myself, John Lidke. Both were going for bus themes. Doug, how is it on the Magic School Bus?
It's just as mystical and educational as I had hoped.
Well, I'm excited to see if Miss Frizzle shows up. I'm strapped in here. We're going 55 miles per hour, as is regulations in this. So this is going to be a pretty fun episode. We'll try to make it fast, too. But it is a special transit edition of Rose City Politics. And we have on the program tonight Jessica Macasset-Bondi and Julian Villafuerte, two of the founders of five founders of Active Transit Windsor Essex, a new transit advocacy group that is seeking for the use and advancement of an interconnected transit system in Windsor Essex. Jessica is a mother, entrepreneur, and community advocate, oversees food services at the Welcome Center for Women and Families, and is a member of the Windsor Bicycling Committee. Jessica, how are you doing tonight?
I'm great. Thanks, John. How are you?
I'm doing great. We're so happy to have you here. I'll talk a little bit later about when we last had you on the show. Let's get right to Julian. Thanks for being here. You are a city builder, a second generation Canadian. And in 2019 and 20, you spearheaded a research project, which we talked about attracting and retaining talent in the region for Workforce Windsor Essex. And you're currently pursuing a master's degree in urban planning at McGill University in Montreal. How are you doing?
I am well. Very happy to be here. Thank you.
We're happy to have both of you here. We all went with the public transit background images. Three out of four went with buses. So Julian, you drew the short straw and you went with the LRT there.
Yes. And this is significant. It's the Lausanne Metro. It's in Switzerland. It's the smallest city in the world to have a metro system. I think their population is like 140,000 people. So it's just to, you know, add fuel to our dreams that maybe in Windsor one day in the future, we could have something more than a bus.
We're getting a trolley, Julian. I don't know if you heard.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, yeah. Like that goes from A to A.
Yes. It's stationary.
It's
best kind of mobility. You don't. Why do we need to go anywhere other than the Beacon? It's the best.
It's a start. I mean, it's a start. You can't deny that much. So we're so excited to have the two of you on. We're going to be talking about this new organization, Active Transit Windsor Essex, that you two are part of a group that's put together. We've got an exclusive interview with Ward 3 Councillor Reno Bordelon, where we have a bit of a brief conversation, or I do rather, about his council motion to redesign and reduce Riverside Drive to two lanes. And he'll explain why it's not a road diet, but it meets a lot of some definitions around that. It's a bit of a nuance issue for him. But that's a really, really interesting conversation that we have. So this is Rose City Politics. We are Windsor's only municipal politics podcast. Please do support us at patreon.com/RoseCityPolitics. Check us out in BizX Magazine, bizxmagazine.com. We're on all of your favorite social media apps, on all of your favorite podcasting apps. And Rose City Politics is able to broadcast live on tape thanks to the kind support of Leuna 625, Building Better Communities. So let's dive in with these two special guests that we have. We're talking about Active Transit Windsor Essex, grassroots advocacy group working for a more accessible and sustainable transportation system in Windsor and Essex. You're building a coalition of community leaders, transit riders, and public transit advocates. Jessica, let's start with you. Tell me about some of the goals of the group. How did this come together?
So we came together, I mean, some of us came together in 2019, and when the More Than Transit Master Plan was coming together. And so, you know, did a little bit of advocating there. There wasn't any funding. Fast forward, you hit a pandemic and transit shuts down. But that ember was always carried. And so, when you look at building the post-pandemic city, we're really excited because, you know, at the beginning of it, earlier this year, we had transit training over in Detroit. It was virtual, but the Motor City Freedom Riders hosted a training, and there was half a dozen people from Windsor there. And so you have to think about, like, okay, there's an interest here to get things going. And so from there, over the summer, we've sort of built ourselves up, really tried to narrow down on what our values are as a group. And we're here now to push our survey and to hit the public.
Well, we last had you on the show to talk about that transit shutdown. I believe that was the last time going through the show notes there. So, well over a year ago now, and transit has actually what sort of still in a just the short period of time fully resumed, although not completely. There's still some shutdowns going on, but it's really interesting that this type of planning you are able to sort of piggyback on some other things that are going on in the region that we have. It's I guess that's one of the great things about living down in these parts. Julian, want to ask you, I guess, why are you doing this? Like, what's the key impetus? You don't have to be doing this. You're not even here.
Yeah, but it's fun and it's something that I believe in. Like, I enjoy, that's just something that I I Jess reached out to me about that, they're setting a transit advocacy group, a bunch of folks. I met Jess and met a bunch of other people. This is during the pandemic. So the first times we were talking, we're just over Zoom, and it sounded like an amazing initiative. And and it's something that, something I really care about a lot and something I really believe Windsor needs is more active democracy. I think it's something that you talked about recently on the show. That's something that, like, Windsor, by just sort of objective measures, is lacking in that. And part of that, depends on elected officials taking some initiative to boost that up. But it's also the citizens that have to keep them accountable, and also the citizens that should participate in creating sort of other modes, other sort of like visions, ideas, like ways of creating those ideas and ways of it setting an example for how we could be building policy. So that's kind of my impetus in being involved in this. And that's, yeah, I love these kind of projects. So, and I'm very, and I have something, more transit is, and more investment in transit is something that I think, like, something that I believe in very strongly. I think that's something that will benefit everybody in Windsor, Essex.
Now, I've got one last question that I want to ask you before we'll bring Doug in, and I'm sure he's got some cross-examination that he's want to go really heavy and fast with. You talk about, I was going through the website, a regional shift that you say is happening. So I'll ask both of you or whoever wants to take it, what is this shift that's occurring? How do you measure such a shift? I'll let you define that as well. And I mean, obviously you're hoping to, ride that wave of it. What are the next steps going to be? I know that you mentioned the survey, and then we'll dive a bit deeper into this topic. Jessica, let's bring you in.
So I think when we talk about, the regional shift happening, it's really hard to sell that before you can improve what existing services we have. So I think our focus as a group initially really has to be, how can we improve the services? How can we push to improve the services that we have? And there's a number of problems that we need to address before we can even think about, seriously offering good services to areas like Tecumseh and Bell River. And so there's a lot of work to be done, and I think we recognize that as a group. We understand that we do want to be able to build the momentum, educate people on the changes that we can make now that will make a difference in the future. So when we look at things, projects that are happening in the future, when roads are being redone, how do we revision those roads so that they're more conducive to active transportation, both cycling and public transportation? Because the cycling part of it is important too, because that is your what they call last mile solution. And most people, especially when you're out in the county, if you're going to a destination, you probably are going to be biking or walking that last little bit, and it might be kind of far from where the bus stop is. So it's beneficial to have good cycling routes too, and that will support public transit use in the county.
Great stuff. So my question, and it's for whoever wants to jump on it or both, is what is your relationship to More Than Transit? The Transit Master Plan, More Than Transit, if I remember correctly, was announced in 2019. There has been extensive public consultation, and many have called it a very ambitious plan to reimagine transit in our community. So I want to hear from you both what you think of, you know, kind of the perspective or that perception of More Than Transit and what you hope to accomplish alongside it.
Yeah, so More Than Transit, we definitely think it is an ambitious plan. We do think that with the single route that's been implemented, that's great. But and we look at the different things that are coming up in the capital budget to help support the, like, for example, the garage. I think we can't talk about any of this without talking about the garage decision coming up and how that is going to impact our ability to increase our services. And so, but also this garage has been around for 50 years. And so how do we want to invest in it so that it's actually not like, we're so stretched thin right now, we're 125% over capacity. How can we prevent that from happening in 50 years from now? So there's a lot to be talked about, and it's coming up in the next couple of months. And so I think when we talk about More Than Transit right now, that's where what we have to talk about. But it is a great plan. I agree with everything you said. And we want to work with Transit Windsor to educate people on what the possibilities are, because a lot of the times with these plans, you get the a great plan, the consultants have done a great job, but then the plan gets shelved and not looked at and not funded. Well, and then what's the point? And we spent all this money on this plan for what reason? So I don't know if there's anything that Julian wants to add, but I think, you know, that's really our position on it, and we're here to help support it.
Yeah, that's like basically our starting point is a starting point of a lot of support for this plan. If this is a lot of the values that are at the base of it, there's mentions of livability, there's the idea to switch to a more radial, not a radial system, but a grid system. Right now we have a radial hub and spoke system, so something that's more grid, more frequency. What they're proposing is increasing the amount of service hours by over 50% compared to current. And basically what we know, and like part of the impetus of creating this group, is that it takes people people involved in the democratic process to push for these kind of things to get implemented, because it's not a guarantee. So so that's part of what we're here to do at the outset. And then, you know, just in the meanwhile, I guess, is to develop a more sort of to be sort of a representative, or hopefully of a group of people, and develop a kind of a more nuanced perspective on what are some other things that we might want to see elaborated about, like the implementation of this plan? What are some other problems that might have emerged as a result of COVID? Or what are some other sort of experiences that people are facing using the transit system that need to be addressed that might not have been mentioned in the plan? So that's part of, you know, that's part of what the survey is for, and that's part of what we hope to do in the, you know, moving forward. But the nice thing, and it's a really amazing, an excellent opportunity for Windsor, is that it already has like a plan that was implemented really recently that is really like on point in terms of what a much better transit system for Windsor could look like. So we're all for it for now. Yeah.
And to add one additional note, when you talk about rebuilding cities in a post-pandemic light, there's now also funding for that. So if we can be that voice to make sure the funding gets put into the right places, that, you know, it's invested in the right spots with the right considerations, I think, you know, now is the right time. So it's more of like a, you know, we're really here to like help seize the day.
When I think about the landscape of our public discourse and media in our community, who has a voice and who has a say, I think my view is that users of public transit and potential users of public transit are underrepresented. That's my opinion. I don't know if you share it or not. But my question to you is, are you hoping to do something about that? Are you hoping to address that, the silence, the relative silence of people who depend on transit and people who might like to be regular transit users?
Yeah, I definitely think we've done a lot of reaching out to different organizations that I would describe as marginalized populations, because right now that's who utilizes transit. You don't utilize transit unless you absolutely need it, because that's the state of our transit. That's what we've funded. So I don't know, like, there's nothing else that we should expect, because this is the system that we have for a reason. We really want to get these voices involved in this conversation. And I think that's part of seeing it done the right way. And so making sure that these, now my background, I work at the Welcome Center. And so we've done sort of extra work to try and work with organizations that serve people experiencing homelessness, because they don't have access to a phone. So our survey is available via mobile. So we've made it available via paper copy to the organizations. We will have to then input the data. It's an extra step for us, but then we know that these voices have been included, and I think that's important. And that's just one example of that. Go ahead, John.
Oh, it's been a while since I got caught by my own mute. That's embarrassing. So people are going to fill these out. You're going to get some good hard data here that's going to be able to hopefully, point you in some right directions about what people are looking for. Julian, I'll bring you in. Where are you going with that data? I mean, this is what your background is sifting through data and presenting data. You've done this before. Are you going to be compiling some kind of a report that people are going to be able to glean things from? I'm sure going to be bringing it forward to elected officials. What's the next steps?
Yeah, that's the idea. Exactly. It's the way we framed it right now is our goal is to create a community mandate. So this data is where this, what we're collecting our perspectives with the survey. And it goes to the point that Doug was saying is what, really important thing that we are aiming to do is to offer a voice to a group of, a big part of the community that is generally not present at a lot of these kind of decision-making spaces for many reasons. Like, our democracy is really far from being perfect. So that's kind of what we're hoping to contribute and collecting these kind of perspectives. And then eventually, yes, like presenting a sort of a mandate, but that's a report is nice. Like, that goes to, those people who make decisions, but it's also to inform our idea or our collective awareness of what transit users and also non-transit users, what they look like, what are their sort of, preferences, desires, what sort of ideas do they have in their minds about like what the transit system should look like in the future. That I think is really important, because otherwise, like, how, without that kind of awareness of where we want to go as a community, how can we make these kind of decisions? So that's kind of what we want to do. And then, so the report is one format of that. Social media, just us talking, I guess. So that's the idea.
Yeah, I'll jump in here. So my background is the Downtown Transit Terminal, which is not the official name for it, but that's what I'm going to call it. And we spent time there today handing out bookmarks to transit riders and talking to people. And not a single person was not, completely enthused by this. Now, maybe some people didn't have time for it, and we tried to respect that. But we had some great conversations today with the community. And so I think that's really a huge part of where we see ourselves coming in, and just making sure that people understand what changes are coming up, where they can have their voices be heard, and then being a way to amplify that is really what we see ourselves doing a lot.
Yeah, I mean, it's such an underrepresented group, obviously, right? I mean, it's not like there's surveys the city does at entrances to the station or to the buses themselves. There wasn't any consultation done when it was shut down throughout the pandemic. I want to get back to just that pandemic focus a little bit and take things back to how much of an impetus was that shutdown in terms of the, I don't want to say the formation of this group specifically, but I would presume in like spurring some conversations, how important was that, or was it not at all? Julian, you're nodding furiously. Jessica, you too.
Well, I would say it was kind of a big hit to efforts that were happening. It was kind of like the final blow of like current efforts that had been popping up. And it made things more difficult to sort of connect with people initially, because you never knew what was happening. You didn't really understand the longevity of it at the beginning of the pandemic. And I think we can all appreciate that now. And so, you know, as we've recovered, I think it's sort of that little ember, I keep using that terminology, but that has really ignited. And I wouldn't say the pandemic sort of, or the shutdown sort of spurred it. I would think that actually hindered it in a way. But I think that when we cannot, we look at COP26. So let's look at a global scale. Let's zoom out for a second. You cannot look at what's happening with COP26 without looking at what's happening on a municipal, like without analyzing municipal decisions. And so we think about, okay, well, how can Windsor be more green? Well, we can electrify our fleet, except for the current infrastructure doesn't support fleet electrification. So, you know, we can't even add more buses to the routes to make transit more, to make it easier for people to use, to make it more convenient, to make it more reliable. We can't put more buses out there because we don't have the infrastructure to support it. And so we really need to take a look at the state of where we're at and where we need to be pushing. But yeah, I'll leave it there.
Okay. What can we look for from you folks in the coming weeks and months? If someone is interested in getting on board and helping the effort in some way, what are you going to be doing, and what are the ways that people can help?
So I think the big ask is just to get people to take the survey. And if people really are passionate about transit and they want to become a member, if they want to keep involved with what's happening, they should. There's a little Get Involved tab on our website. That would be a great place to start. You can fill out the contact form and we will send you an email. And so, and just, you know, when we will be hosting events in the coming weeks. We're going to be at St. Clair College sometime in the month of November, still have yet to nail down a date, and we'll be at other transit terminals throughout the month. So we're really looking forward to talking to transit riders there. But whether or not you're a transit rider, we want to hear your comments on the survey. So, you know, if anybody is listening, go to Activate. So it's activatetransitwindsoressex.ca. If you go to the main page of the site, there's a button there. You can just click to take the survey. So that would be a good place to start for people. And then up in the menu there, you can hit get involved and fill out your contact info. And then we can send you emails letting you know what we're doing in the community.
Yeah, people can also just message us on social media. We, we're on Instagram, we're on Twitter now, Facebook. We had a pretty good system set up, so great. Very proud of it.
just slide into the DMs. You know, it's interesting. I'm just going to burn a bit of air right now while we get this queued up here for the next segment. But it's interesting when you talk about, Jessica, the need to, sure, we want to go and electrify the fleet, but we don't have the infrastructure today to do that. We have to, you know, get the new garage. We have to make sure that we have everything rolled out in the capacity to do it. It's just, if you look at it through that lens, it's, you go, wow, so we're at the best that we can do right now. And then you look at what we're doing and you go, that's the best that we can do right now. And it's a really interesting double-edged, I don't know what I'm saying.
A great example of that as well is the 518X, the expressway route. We added, you know, it comes once every 35 minutes. And so it exists. Great. That's the first route of the transit master plan that's been implemented, but it's not very convenient. And so, you know, that will come in time. Great. But how can we make that faster? Because, you know, if we build it, they will come. And you really see that. There was a story out today. I think it was Jennifer LaGrassa from CBC talking about e-scooters and how that's brought more businesses, has brought more business to areas like Ford City and downtown. And so people are going out, they're spending money. And I think Chris Holt put told you so, because it's true. And
Yeah.
so now that's just e-scooters. Imagine seeing good transit where you can get from, where I live in Ward 1 to downtown without it taking 3 hours. So, on a weekend. So, because that's the truth. By the time we walk to the bus stop, by the time we take the bus where we need to go, it's a couple hours later, and nobody's got has time for that. So how do we make it to easier to do that?
How do you
Yeah.
make life convenient for our residents in the city and not a hindrance? Well, we're going to be talking a bit about that CBC article that Jennifer LaGrassa there put up in a bit. But what we're going to do right now, I mentioned at the top, we had an interview, exclusive one, with Councillor Reno Bordelon, Ward 3, where we talk about his motion. It's all wrapped up in the Festival Plaza, and the canopy was what received all of the media attention at the very beginning of this. We covered it at the outset. Councillor Bordelon's motion that he'll go into, it's more focused. It's really focused on Riverside Drive as a whole and reducing it to two lanes. So without further ado, I will let the councillor speak for himself, but I will give a bit of a heads up right now. If you are watching along on YouTube, it gets a little bit jumpy here or there. That's just the fun of doing Zooms in a pandemic. So, live with us, but overall, take a listen. It's a really interesting conversation. Counselor, thank you for joining us here on Rose City Politics. We are talking about active transportation, but wanted to speak with you about your motion pertaining to primarily Riverside Drive and what we've discussed before as a road diet. You're looking to see something like that put in permanently, but we just had a conversation about how I'm off base and how road diet is not the most apt term for this. So I guess could you explain to me and the listeners, what is it that you're looking to see fulfilled on Riverside Drive? And I guess just to start off, why is that the wrong word?
I don't know if you're offside, but I think it's just changing the discussion. I mean, semantics matters because these issues become hot button issues. I fully expect Don to say some dumb things tonight, about the war on the car and always taking away, basically reducing speeds and taking away people's options in the car. And that this isn't what it's about. It's really about redesigning the street to meet the needs of everybody in that area. So realistically, tens of thousands of people come down to the riverfront every day, and every week we're seeing thousands between Walkerville and Sandwich Town. There's huge uptake on the riverfront. A lot of those people don't naturally spill into the neighborhoods, and we see it. We see it everywhere. We see it downtown. We see it in the neighborhoods. People who live in the neighborhoods east of the casino have to walk, quite a few blocks to get to a light to get to cross over. And with four lanes of speeding traffic, it is not comfortable. It's a very, we've seen people call it a wall, with a mini highway. These are things that make it very uncomfortable for you to be able to cross and basically engage in your riverfront. If you live anywhere along that stretch, it should be this big permeable road where you can cross anywhere, feel safe anywhere. Also, it would allow people to have to create economic development opportunities. If you look at the area from east of the casino between Walkerville and downtown, the south side of that street needs to be engaged with the riverfront. Imagine cafes with patios overlooking the riverfront. You don't want that when speeding cars are driving by. So all of this to say is that we're not taking anything away in a road diet, and that's kind of what the semantics insinuates. What we want to do is we want to redesign it. We make physical changes that we're looking at it holistically from one end to the other, and then focus on how all users are going to use it. And the reality is, even drivers and people commuting won't see a huge impact, because by the time you leave downtown and you get to Walkerville, there's a huge lineup to merge into one lane at Devonshire anyway. And so realistically, you're probably adding 30 seconds to your commute, but it's also safer. And it's also less stressful, because if we've, anybody who's driven the stretch east of the casino knows how tight those lanes are, and it becomes stressful when there's a lot of traffic there. And so for a couple of times during the day, when traffic is coming into downtown and when traffic is leaving at after work, there will be maybe an added 30 seconds to your commute. But what it will do for everybody along that stretch, any pedestrians, cyclists, and everybody looking to engage with the neighborhoods, it'll make it safer, easier, and more compelling to actually seep into downtown. Right now, a lot of those tens of thousands of people that come to the riverfront on a weekly basis don't naturally seep into the downtown core, and they should. And so this is, you know, you tie it in with the scooters, you tie it in with other things that are happening, you tie it in with a lot of the districting that we're looking to do downtown, and you will pull people in as long as that connection feels safe and it feels like something that it feels like a natural flow into the downtown.
So what are some outstanding misconceptions that might still be out there rather than just, you know, the branding around it?
Well, the misconceptions are just that it'll slow me down. It's going to add so much time. You know, there are people who would even be so bold as to say that, you know, when there's congestion, cars are idling more, so it's worse for the environment. All of these are bizarre myths, and bizarre myths that have been blown out of the water in cities across North America already. And so the more we choose to continually design things for people in their cars, the more we will miss the mark. And unfortunately, the other aspect of this is that the pushback will come from those commuters that you're talking about. So the commuters, we're going to add, you know, anywhere from 30 seconds plus to their commute. When you really think about that, it's ludicrous that would even be an issue. But we live in a city where commuting is taken for granted, because you can come from Bell River to come see anywhere into downtown, and it's 25, 30 minutes, and it's no big deal. It's okay to make that longer. It's okay to make it less pleasant to commute from Bell River to downtown for the benefit of the people who live in these areas, so that they don't have to play Frogger with their lives in their hands to cross the road and get to this beautiful riverfront. To your point about economic development, we talk about, we don't want anything north of Riverside Drive to be developed, you know, no, nothing to go above the Crown. We don't want any commercialized at all. But why isn't the south side just teeming with businesses, basically, like I mentioned, a cafe overlooking this million-dollar view? There should be dozens of them. It should be almost prime property for all of that. One of the reasons is the way that the road is designed, and it's not meant to slow down and come into a business. And so, and what we just saw with the Bird scooters and their sort of midterm report card, and how businesses are saying, businesses have seen a boom from active transportation, from things like the scooters and from people having options. So we tend to appeal to the commuters in a situation like this, and some of those commuters are not Windsor residents, as opposed to the people who actually live in those areas and would benefit from walking and connecting to the waterfront. So are there any negatives to this? There's a cost, so there will be a cost, but to me, that's not necessarily a negative. That's an investment in the community that we'll see huge returns on. And I think realistically, if we're prepared to spend $35 million to help bring people down to the waterfront for Festival Plaza, when we know that only happens for 30, 40 nights of the year, we should be prepared to make this safer for, you know, $15, $20 million that brings tens of thousands of people down to the riverfront weekly. So this is the kind of discussion that has to happen, because we have to get past the myths, right? This is always, it always will come up. I guarantee you it'll come up this time. You know, I know somebody will complain about parking in there somewhere. This is the perpetual conversation where they feel that it's taking away some right as an automobile driver, whereas it's not doing that at all. It's just making it better for everyone. more so it's a safety issue. People on the trail are there with their kids, with their strollers. Their kids are learning how to rollerblade. The kids are crossing the trails this way. There's it becomes a safety issue. You shouldn't be riding your bike faster than 15 kilometers an hour on that stretch or on those bike paths. When a commuter is coming in, let's say a commuter is coming in from Riverside and works downtown, they want to be riding 25, 30 kilometers an hour. They want to get straight to downtown to work. I like to tell people, would we close, you know, let Dougal, Tecumseh and tell motorists to use the alleys as an option? That's what you're telling people when you're telling people to use these trails, these multi-use trails, because now all of a sudden a commuting cyclist is on a trail with rollerbladers, moms with strollers, all kinds of things, scooters, all kinds of things that are happening. Whereas if they're in a bike lane, it's a bike lane, and it's a bike lane that's getting them to and from work. And we don't understand what the commuter cyclist actually needs and deals with, because we still see, to your point, we still see cycling as this recreation that could also get us to work if we're going that way.
Now, last question I have for you. You say you're all for active transportation, you know, protecting the users of that. Why then are you so opposed to the tunnel at the riverfront, which would have protected them from vehicles far more than what you're proposing? And why were you opposed to that tunnel linking the riverfront to the Esplanade City Hall Square? Why is what you're proposing better?
Well, because it does a few things. The tunnel is a singular point of contact. So wherever we put it, originally it was in front of the art gallery, then it was moved down to basically behind Festival Plaza and where it'll link up with the Civic Esplanade. It's one connection point. So people would have to go to that one connection point. The second part is it basically admits that we have a highway above us. And so we're going to give you this $25 million safe space to cross. It really is putting a focus on the wrong things. The cost is exorbitant. It always has been exorbitant. Nobody has ever wanted this tunnel. What it does is that these tunnels have been proven over and over again that when they're in areas like this, you know, fine, after a concert at Festival Plaza, there might be a lot of people that using come up. But on an average Monday night in November, who's in that tunnel? What's going to happen is somebody will walk down the Civic Esplanade, go to use a tunnel, not feel safe because there may be people sleeping in the tunnel, loitering in the tunnel, doing things in the tunnel that are not legal, and they're not going to feel safe. And the first time they encounter that, they're never going to use that tunnel again. And when you come to use that tunnel, you are in a hidden area, in potentially a dark, it may be well lit inside, but it's dark behind you. There isn't many people around. And so you're putting yourself in a dangerous situation, or at least a perceived dangerous situation, and you're not going to come back. And so the whole issue should be realistically that we shouldn't accept that there's a four-lane highway dissecting our beautiful riverfront and our downtown, and we should make it more permeable. And there needs to be many access points. It's not about one access point. We need to move away from that. This motion kills the tunnel once and for all, and we can move on and talk about other connection points.
So that was my interview that I had earlier today with Councillor Bordelon. Covered a lot of topics there in the one topic itself. Doug, I want to ask you, though, just dive into the first part. It's a bit of the facetious joke I made at the top of it, but how important do you think it is, the nuanced take on it? I mean, you know, in politics, the branding and the marketing is always important. There's numerous examples, you know, in down south where things have had to be rebranded to be sold. Do you think that he's on the right track here with not wanting to focus on what would be probably perceived to be more of a negative term, especially here in, you know, the automotive capital of Canada?
Yeah, you know, I think that is a smart choice. The people who drive cars and who are, you know, and I drive a car to work every day, but people who are motorists and identify themselves as motorists, I think are deeply suspicious of, you know, things that are going to change their level of access Their ability to move at speed, their ability to move efficiently, their ability to park their car wherever they want. I think there is a suspicion there. And I think that that suspicion is part of just what you're touching on. It has been engendered by cynical politicians. Pandering politicians who pander to people's self-interest and then create a perceived threat to that self-interest are a real problem. This is something that we could have a mature conversation as a community about, and I think find a way to coexist between motorists, pedestrians, users of transit, users of active transportation. There is plenty of room in this city for all of us to have what we need. But if we start every conversation with, oh my God, you can't offend the car people, it's going to be really, really hard to move the needle anywhere. So I think that is a reasonable thing. Now I've got a question for you, John. I noticed that lovely sweater vest that you were wearing in the video with Councillor Bordeland today. And I've got to ask you, are you not concerned about wearing that stuff on Zoom? Because, you know, I have one that's not too different in my closet. And after the first couple of Zoom meetings, I just stopped wearing it because it just looks like I'm in my terry cloth bathrobe. And so what I want to know from you is, are you aware of this? And are you leaning into that Hefner thing? Or was that just a happy accident for my amusement?
Yeah, that was a happy accident. Now I'm going to have to, you know, strongly consider wearing that specific sweater moving forward, though. Thank you for pointing that one out there.
You're welcome. It's what I do.
Nothing wrong with being comfortable in the Zooms, though. I mean, that's the one thing that we've learned over these past months.
All four of us have jogging pants below the waist. Let's like, there's no lies here. Come on. We all know what the Zoom work uniform looks like. It doesn't matter how formal you are up here. Everything down below the edge of the screen is fair game.
Now,
guilty.
Jessica, you're off mute. So let's bring you in right now. You know, we're talking about reducing the size of Riverside down to two lanes, putting in, you know, dedicated bike lanes, the hope to spur economic development along the south side of Riverside Drive. And then, of course, the crossings. What an amazing amount of crossings versus just that tunnel. And it's the crossings that I wanted to speak with you about. How important do you think it's going to be if this does go forward that, you know, you'll be virtually able to cross Riverside Drive from any, you know, I say intersection, because they're not really intersections. If you're trying to cross the street, if you're in a car, you can get up to like, you know, 35 and get around a corner pretty quickly if someone's whipping around. But how important do you think it's going to be to have that actual connection without having to go way out of your own way?
Yeah, I think whatever we can do to make the streets more conducive to people walking, biking, and just being able to get around that way to make them safer for the e-scooters even, because that's become a big piece of the waterfront now too, right? And so I think whatever we can do to make the streets safer for that, we really need to be focusing on that. So yeah, I think that's the obvious thing you would think, but then not so obvious.
Julian, I got a question for you. You're the closest to a coastal elite that we have right now on the show, being up in Montreal. You know, you did the attraction and retention report, which touched on a lot of this kind of stuff from different angles, of course. I guess, you know, I want to ask you about the economic development angle that Councillor Bordeland was talking about, and just how he would hope that it might spur that kind of development. And, you know, living where you are right now, I guess, just as a jumping off point, you know, what would your colleagues and friends that you've met and you're spending time up there think if they were to see the riverfront that we have and the state that it's in as just a thoroughfare connecting, you know, neighborhood to neighborhood and not having, you know, a place to get a cup of coffee or have a glass of wine or a pint of beer or a salad?
Yeah, basically right now it's a poor use of space. It's poor land. and that's the thing. That's the issue with, you know, just the conversation in general and like what we were talking about, how motorists tend to be defensive about these kind of changes, but at the end of the day, these kind of changes benefit everyone, including motorists. Like these, this kind of thing, if you want to call it a road diet, like fine, has happened in literally hundreds of cities, and especially recently, like, and in COVID, you know, even more. And the benefits of always, you know, there's been a lot of studies that have been done about the benefits of allocating more space to, you know, in places that have been really car dependent or like really car oriented in their design, reallocating space to other modes of transport. And then, you know, the benefits are either there's no change, but more like, you know, more often there is positive benefit in terms of, obviously you can move more people, you can do more stuff with the space, and then you create a space that's safer. So like more things happen, create a space that's quieter, it's nicer. And then the thing is with, in terms of like how people get around, like people adapt. And you know, in this context, like with specifically with Riverside Drive, like there are other ways to drive around. And plus when you're allocating so much of that space to other modes of transport, maybe people won't drive anymore. Maybe they'll take other modes. So that's, so at the end of the day, as a motorist, like, are you really that affected? No, like as far as your driving. And if anything, like, oh, well, now you also have like really positive things. You have a nicer waterfront, maybe some more destinations to go visit. So everyone wins.
Yeah, you know, I think too, there's a generational aspect to this. And one of the things that a community that has low voter turnout, like Windsor, one of the things that happens is that voters skew to higher socioeconomic status and they skew older. I think, and this is my perception, being an old myself, I can only sort of look and perceive the young folks, but what I, and maybe the actual young people who are our guests tonight might want to weigh in on this, but you know, I see less attachment to the car, generationally, the younger millennials and, the Tide Pod generation coming up behind them. They seem to be less attached to owning a vehicle as this emblem of freedom, as this thing that makes you a complete adult. You know, I know some pretty successful and relatively wealthy people in their early 30s who have no thought of owning a vehicle. And in Windsor, to decide that a vehicle is not for you and not because of need or, you know, because of whatever difficulties in your life, but because you just don't want one. I think that there's, you know, I think that there's a real risk that we are making our city not attractive to a whole swath of young people who represent our economic and social future. And I'd like to hear, like I said, some actual young people weigh in on that.
Yeah, I'm happy to weigh in on that for sure. I would say like it's probably true, but there's obviously like there are still young people who like cars. I mean, I think maybe one thing that we've realized is that like this is my, you know, my opinion and my peers, like we realize cars are not freedom. Like as a society, if we make a choice to, you know, have a society based on cars, we also renounce the choice to have a society where we can just like walk to the cafe or like go outside walking with our kid or whatever that like plays in the street, you know. We renounce a lot of choices by making that call. So by not making that choice and, you know, making a choice to either, but that's the thing is that we can have a balanced transportation system that also accommodates cars, you know, and that's at the end of the day, like, you know, with this kind of conversations about road diets and stuff, like I personally never say that, oh, I'm part of like, I'm on the one side of the war on cars. Like there doesn't have to be a war. Like we just have to like, you know, tone back a little bit the space that cars play. And then, you know, at the end of the day, like it would be really cool if Windsor could aim to be a city where all these modes of transportation are accommodated. And that's totally possible. It's like what exists in a lot of places in the world. So yeah, for sure. I think that's like as a whole, like Windsor, you know, on this like talent attraction piece, if you will, like it's just creating a space where everybody has the option to get around the way that they want to get around.
Yeah, you did say earlier though that people might stop driving a car and then start using alternative forms of transit. So that like that is like that's a declarative attack on the car.
No, but it's like those are the people that will want to do that. You know what I mean? So that, like that's
still
like,
I'm not saying, still oh, one down for the car. Sorry, just joking with that one. Doug, did you have a follow-up you wanted to ask? No. Okay. Let's flow with this one then, you know, into, we were talking a bit earlier about the e-scooter pilot that we're in. We're at the 6 month mark. So the midterm report card, oh man, I hate that term for things that don't have to do with school, but you know, so we've seen some data that's come out, over 135,000 rides, longest ride time in Canada with 25 minute average time, which, you know, I think that one makes sense. We've got a pretty long riverfront. So people are probably, we know from some of the upcoming statistics here, the most common starting points are downtown and the Great Canadian Flag. So, you know, with such a large riverfront, it makes sense that people are, you know, taking it from one end to the other and coming back. The average rider has 5 trips. Many are repeat riders. And people, as we mentioned, Councillor Bordelon mentioned it in the pre-conversation I had with him as well. People are taking these scooters to other BIAs, Walkerville, Via Italia, Sandwich Town, Ford City. Basically, they're taking them where they're able to get to in the geo zone that it's locked down to right now. The University of Windsor has now partnered with Bird. But the coolest thing is that, as you were saying, Jessica, and I'll bring you back in just to further that thought, we're seeing business owners in Ford City, Sandwich, and Ottawa Street saying, we're seeing new customers. We have people that are coming in here that have never been here before, that wouldn't be here, that have said it would take me too long if I were to take a bus, or if I were to, I wouldn't take an Uber, $12 just to come here for, you know, no reason. But if I'm riding around, having a fun day, just, you know, getting around, it spurs that kind of development. This is nothing new to people who study this kind of thing, but Jessica, what's your take about, you know, hearing things that are, you know, anecdotal, but now they're actually based on some pretty local you know, people and who are saying it's a positive?
Yeah, I am sorry, I didn't even read ahead when I brought it up earlier, but yeah, I'm really excited about this piece, because I think that it's important to talk about the numbers, you know, when they come back, when we have done these pilots and said, and now to be able to say it's working. And it was really, it was Chris Holt that I saw posted about it, and with the hashtag told you so, because, and I completely agree. And when we think about what we're doing with transit and like how that could have an impact, if you like scale it up a little bit, I'm really excited about it. So, yeah.
So I'm not a scooter rider, and I was pretty skeptical of these things because I come at it from the perspective of a downtown pedestrian. I don't ride scooters, but I do an awful lot of walking around downtown, and I know what it's like to share the sidewalks with cyclists, and I was not excited to also share the sidewalks with 35 kilometer an hour scooters. But I have to say that my personal experience has been pretty positive. You see lots of people using them. You see them out and about on the street and in the alleys. Very rarely do you see them actually being used on sidewalks. I was concerned about the litter, the sort of abandoned scooters littering the sidewalk. We've seen instances of that in other communities. Mike Moffitt, who's been on this show before, has had a series of increasingly enraged tweets about the abandoned scooters in his neighborhood in Ottawa. Really haven't seen that here, and haven't seen any voices, you know, raising those concerned or those concerns. So I have to say it's been a pretty successful start. And if it's bringing, if it's moving people around the city and helping people to experience other parts of the community that they wouldn't otherwise experience, it is just, that's just absolutely fantastic. My calculator tells me that 135,000 rides with 5 trips per average rider means that something like 27,000 people, individual unique people, have taken a ride on a Bird scooter. That's an amazing number when you consider the size of our city.
That is, it's a staggering number, and that there are so many people that are doing it on a repeat basis. I mean, it shows there is, I mean, like there's demand for it. Now, people using it up to 5 times, it doesn't show that it's being used as a regular means of transportation by any mean, but it would be nice to, after the full year, see a further breakdown. And if they could come back and say, oh, wow, you know, 2 to 5% of our riders are core riders. And some of the other stats that we saw, we aren't seeing much of an uptick right now on the equity pricing program that the city offers. So, you know, people are still using alternative forms of transportation, but I think that's to be expected. If people are going to be trying to get across the city or from one neighborhood to another neighborhood to get to work, the scooter is not the best way to do it all the time. You know, I'm thinking rain, snow, sleet, all the stuff that Canada Post and the American Post Office has to do, but they get the tiny new trucks. Julian, though, let's bring your voice up.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that this story is a great example of how adding any, you know, additional means of mobility or transport in the city is good. Like, what happens is that people just move around more. And then that benefits the people and that benefits the businesses that become the destinations or the other things. So, you know, I think it's great for that. And, you know, and that goes for any mode of mobility, including cars. Like, that's like, this is like a rule in like transport economics called induced demand. So like, if you add another lane in the highway, then it's like, it doesn't mean that there's going to be more free flowing traffic. It just means that more cars will get there. But yeah, and then that's, I mean, that goes for transit as well. It goes for biking as well. And it goes back to this whole thing about the Riverside Drive thing. If you just add more options for people to get around by foot or by bike or by scooter, then more people will. And then that means just like, you know, in terms of like economic development, if you will, this is great. So that's all just to say, like, that's the moral of the story that I take from this is, adding more options is always good that are not just cars.
Now, how does adding another highway pretty close to another highway fit into that whole system of demand?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Like, if you add just another highway, then more people will drive and you'll have more, I don't know, and that's what you'll end up getting, you know, like, which is like, if that's what you want as like your goal, like, cool. But like, is that really the best thing, you know, to design something that's so dependent on one mode of transportation? And is that the best for businesses? You know, at the end of the day, it's like when we have something that accommodates these other modes of mobility, then people will be more likely to go to the little place in Fort City instead of, I don't know, somewhere far away.
Well, let's scoot on to the, oh God, why did I do that? Let's talk about this last topic here. Yeah, thank you for the scornful eyes, Doug. I need more of that when those kind of things slip through. Last story here, we're not going to dive too deep into it, but I want to do a surface hit on it. So the city of Windsor last week announced 7 kilometers of new and improved trails nearing completion at 7 city parks. $2 million is spent on 3-meter wide asphalt trails and other improvements in 7 city parks. We can talk about the parks they're going into. Wards 1, 7, 8, 9, and 10 are seeing them. So there's a bit of a political conversation about why they're going, where they're going. But what I really wanted to talk to you two about, Jessica and Julian, about this is, you know, these are trails in parks. And parks are places where people go to for recreation. And I want to just read two of the quotes here as the jumping off point about this. Mayor Dilkins says, investments in premium bicycling and parks infrastructure are good for physical and mental well-being and for the health of our economy. We know these amenities increase property values and make our community more desirable to families and investors. You know, I don't disagree with anything. I think, though, when he says premium bicycling and parks infrastructure, that's the key sticking out point for me right off the top. And then you have Councillor Juan Gill saying these trails are very highly used by residents in our ward. So expanding and refurbishing them will give residents an improved and safer place for physical activity. These enhancements will allow for greater access to leisure activities, which in turn encourage healthy living. Now, this is something I spoke with Councillor Bordelon about, and it didn't quite make it into the video, the interview that you saw, but he did reference it. And it's this idea, it's something that I've talked about over and over again, and you guys have as well, is these investments are in recreation. These are not investments in transportation. And, you know, how much do you think this all links back into the effort that you guys are undertaking with the new group here? But much like, you know, Councillor Bordelon was saying the road diet was the wrong branding, how difficult do you think it's going to be to overcome what most Windsorites, at least you know, anecdotally on surface value seem to be with cycling to be, you know, it's recreation. It's a good way to get out for an hour and, you know, you feel better and it's good for your mental health, but it's not, you know, transportation to get to A to B. What's it going to be like to get over that hill? Julian first, and then Jessica, I want to hear you too.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, it's kind of promising to read those quotes because it's almost as if they get it, which is, and maybe they do. And it's like not very, you know, it just takes a little bit of political courage to like apply that and realize like, oh, well, maybe cycling is also really good for, it has like many benefits, like, you know, the health benefits, the leisure benefits, the property value benefits too. But also like, you know, there's the transportation system benefits. You know, maybe they'll get that, but it just takes that political courage because it does cost something, which is it does cost space on the road, which is a huge, you know, there are politicians, like even in Vancouver, like Gregor Robertson, former mayor, like he kind of like died on that hill, which is kind of rough. But then, you know, like 5 or 6 years later, then people like really got onto it. And like now, like there's a lot of support for bike lanes because people realize like, oh, what a great way to get around. And like, this is really good for my health, you know, like personally speaking in Montreal, like that's how I get around. That's how I get to school every day. And I just get like, you know, 40 minutes of biking, you know, daily. And it's really nice. And I get to see all these like beautiful things on the way and beautiful people. And it's fun. But yeah, so that's, what does it take to get over that hill? I mean, one thing that I always think about in Windsor is that Windsor organizes open streets, which I think is a really cool way that people like experience like the benefit of that. And it's, I mean, if I was in charge, I would realize like, oh, that's a really great way to kind of calm down a little bit of the anger around it. And in that place, like kind of put some hope and some realization of like, oh, this is actually beneficial for me, even if I'm a motorist. But the thing is that like so many people in Windsor have bikes and like, you know, that's why they're making so many of these investments or they obviously, you know, or they're able to get around like as if they're pedestrians too. So that's the thing. Like, we just have to realize that people will go when that happens and when there somebody takes the leadership to make it happen. So that's kind of like what our group is also here for, is just to push for that.
I love the optimism because you heard those quotes and you were optimistic, and I brought those quotes in because I was being cynical, and I heard it completely the opposite. Jessica, I guess, you know, I'll ask you as well, what was your take on the quotes, and then, you know, further expand from there?
Yeah, so I see this news kind of on the middle ground, and let me bring my perspective there. So I use Central Park frequently while I did this summer for yoga. We did outdoor yoga, that's pandemic life. And it's a nice park, definitely could see how some improvements would make it better. But the other thing is, it's not a very easy park to cycle to. And so I don't live terribly far, but I would drive. And so I'm, you know, when we're looking at making these trail upgrades and making these investments in these parks, we also have to look at connecting them to things. And so if we're going to take that time to do that, it, you know, there's another piece to that conversation. And so I think in that way, you know, we can see it as a positive because it's the start of a conversation. It's the start of investing in these areas that bring people outside, that get people, you know, out in interacting with their city. But then also there's how do we bring them there, you know, not just with a car? So how do we get trails? This mentions trails, but I imagine this is trails inside Central Park. But I'm talking about trails connecting to Central Park, to the Herb Gray Trail, which is not far from that area. So, you know, yeah, that's another piece of it. And I think, you know, I would consider that the middle ground because I do see how it's positive, but there's also a lot of work to be done in that way too.
You're on mute, Jonathan.
Twice in a show. Gosh, I'm going to have to leave if it happens one more time. I like what you were saying there, Jessica, about the need to, you know, link these amenities to broader infrastructure to be able to access them. I think too, a couple parks that are on Riverside Drive on the way up to the Peace Fountain area. And they look like some of the coolest little parks. There's like 4 or 5 little benches and it's right on the waterfront. And there's like 3 or 4 of these parks, but there's no parking. There's no bike lanes in that area whatsoever. And so you're left to think like, well, who are these parks for? oh, the people who live in the immediate vicinity of those parks. Well, why aren't there more benches or lanes? Because they don't want you there. That's the only thing to take away from it. So I just wanted to add, you know, another one of my cynical looks on it. And I hope that one day I get to use those parks, because I've also been physically barred from going into any of them. I don't know why.
Well, John, that's what happens when you anger the powers that be with your incisive commentary. Sorry, Jessica, I interrupted you for a joke.
Oh, no, that's okay. I was honestly just looking at all of this and thinking it's easy to get people excited about parks right now, especially we've been cooped up in our houses for a year and a half. But it's less easy to get, like, for all of this money that we're spending, we could, you know, at the same time put in good. And I know it's part of the plan, but and we're doing that little bits at a time. But, you know, we were out taking pictures of bus stops. And the state of some of our bus stops in the city is really, really, really sad. And I know it's all changing, but, you know, it's not as easy to get people excited about putting in a nice bench for people waiting to take transit versus just like literally standing outside of somebody's house. That's what my bus stop is. It's at the end of the somebody's driveway, essentially. And there's just a pole with a sign on top of it. And you're just sort of lurking around at the neighborhood houses.
So I think the best take on these trails in the parks and this investment, the best take on it was from an anonymous account on Facebook, which many of us believe is a City of Windsor employee who posts commentary and thoughts in order to avoid being fired or otherwise sanctioned. And that take was that these trails are being widened for pickup truck access. They are being widened so that parks employees can more easily access different parts of the park with their pickup trucks. And so what's really happening here is some administrative convenience is now being repackaged and sold by the politicians as this wonderful community benefit for active transportation. And that to me sounds about right. I think that is probably what we're talking about here. I don't think we need to like read too much further into it. Julian, I really love your optimism, man. We need you on the show more. It's really wonderful, but come on, these guys are just saying what they got to say so that the cameras will take their picture and put them in the newspaper. That's, I think, what was going on here.
I am honestly so impressed. That's a really good way to sell that.
Well, I mean, I think it's probably absolutely right in the sense that we've seen this happen at Willisted Park. We've seen this episode before. We see how this goes. The trails were widened. The Save Willisted Park group, Walkerville and Walkerville's, you know, most prominent residents weren't able to stop this. And I think that there probably is a lot of logic in what this anonymous account is posting. Anyone else running anonymous accounts or thinking of starting one, you know, slide into our DMs.
Well, that is a rare case where most of the time, and I think you guys know my perspective on anonymous accounts, they're good for, I will make two exceptions. If you're funny and only funny, go ahead, be anonymous, poke fun. Or if like the person that we're talking about, you are sharing genuinely useful and interesting information at the risk of your employment, be anonymous. Otherwise, like, kind of screw off with that stuff.
Yeah, we've talked about that before. If you're just going to be there to like make fun of people and advance a political agenda, just, you know, do it on your own account, because we'd all appreciate that. And then we could talk about you on the show too.
Yeah, maybe that's the reason.
Like, just to touch on something, and like with this whole transit experience, it's hard to do things the right way. It's easy to point out all the problems that are happening in the city and talk about how crap transit is, and it's much more difficult to actually do something about it, to actually get enough voices together. So I think, you know, when we talk about anonymous accounts and all of that, like, if you want to really put in the work, there's work to be done. But I think, like, you got to do it in the right way, and it takes time and it takes having conversations. And we're really learning that right now.
It's especially a bad look if you are a failed political candidate who wants to vent their bitterness anonymously on the internet. That is the worst look if we're getting specific about anonymous accounts.
It's awful. Just let sleeping dogs lie, or, you know, take the ownership yourself, as I said. But Jessica, Julian, you know, we've reached the end here of our transit themed episode. I want to thank you both so much for coming on. I think what you're both trying to undertake here, and, you know, the rest of your team, huge undertaking, trying to change the mindset of the automotive capital of Canada, the current and future home of the automobility capital of Canada, to try to completely upend things the way that they are. But not only that, you know, reach onto the shelf and pull off the two plans that we have, the Transit Master Plan and the Active Transit Master Plan, to shine a spotlight on those. We've spent a lot of money. Councillor Borderland, he made the comment in the interview when it came to the environmental assessments for Riverside Drive. You know, we waste so much money if we don't do anything. So at the very least, let's try to, you know, follow through. So keep up the good work with it. And if anyone wants to get involved, you know, they're looking for your input. They want you to fill out a survey. And I'm sure they're also looking for, you know, boots on the ground at some point in the future too. But we're going to move on here to For Your Consideration, where I know, Doug, you've got one, and then I've got one that I want to do too. And then that'll take us out for the night.
Sure. So mine is an item from CBC Windsor. This was published, written by Jacob Barker, and published today. Some Windsor, Ontario high school students sit during O Canada to bring attention to Indigenous issues. So some students in Windsor, Ontario are not standing for the national anthem. They've got, Barker did a good job here, I think. He's got some quotes from students on both sides. And there's a comment from Scott Scantleberry, spokesperson for the public school board, who said, you know, the board supports student voices, and if any students saw being pulled aside for not standing as punitive, it was certainly not the intent. And if it was perceived that way, we apologize. It's an interesting piece, and I encourage you to take a look at it. I think that there is a lot to think about and read there. And I don't want to talk about it in relation to National Truth and Reconciliation Day. You know, that's an issue that that I think people have to wrestle with and think about. And you know, if that's your reason for sitting for the national anthem, that's, you know, that's fair enough. But what struck me is that we still make kids stand for the national anthem every day, stand at attention, take off their hats, that type of thing. And it's kind of shocking to me. You know, one of the comments in the article from one of the students was that it would be disrespectful to veterans not to stand at attention for the national anthem. And it really got me thinking, like, is this 1958? The idea that, you know, that Canadians' pride in their country and Canadians' sense of patriotism and connectedness is somehow driven by forcing children to stand at attention for the national anthem 25,000 times while they're in school. That seems really antiquated to me. And I was surprised to discover that this is actually enshrined in the Education Act. This is something that is, you know, that is Ontario law, that school boards must implement, you know, some policy around this type of thing. And anyway, I don't have any, you know, recommendations or demands. I was shocked by that and surprised. And it's not really, when I think about the reasons why I'm a Canadian patriot and proud to be a Canadian, and and the things that instilled those feelings in me, it was the talk about Canadian values. It was understanding the shared history of this country, all of the parts of the shared history of this country, understanding what, you know, what Canadian values are in terms of how we drive together in the public square, and how we connect to one another. Those are the things that are meaningful to me. And having to stand up and take off my hat is not part of that. Anyway, for your consideration.
It's a good one. I'll do a uncommon response to it. I think forced patriotism has three outcomes. One is aloofness to it. The other is, you know, really hyperbolic exaggeration, the kind of which we saw after, you know, September 11th down south, where freedom fries and came about and freedom toast instead of French fries. But then on the far scale, I think forced patriotism could lead to nationalism, and, you know, forced nationalism is never a good thing, and that's led to some bad things in the past.
Well, at best, you know, I think it's a sign of like national insecurity. When you think about, think about all the kids in the schoolyard that you knew, and the kid who was always telling you how awesome his dad was and all the great toys that he had and how fast he could run and how smart he was. What did you think about that kid? And what do you think that kid thought about himself?
Kid sucked.
That's exactly what I was thinking, Doug. I was just thinking about like how in France they have a much more refined and interesting sense of national identity, but they don't stand up for the national anthem, nor do they have flags everywhere. They don't need that. They know what it means to be French. So that's just something that in Canada we need to work on. We need to figure out what it means.
Everything's a lot more refined after three glasses of red wine and a baguette.
It's true. I do fly a flag in front of my house, to be fair. I contain multitudes, folks.
Well, I like that. Thank you, Doug, for that one. For your consideration, Windsor Star's Brian Cross put this one out. We have a city councilor, Joanne Geniac, Ward 6, who is very concerned, very frightened about a cannabis consumption patio that is being built abutting onto a cannabis retail shop in the Riverside area. She's made a formal request for administration to delve into what powers the city has to control such a use. Spoiler alert, none whatsoever, as cannabis retail stores are granted exclusively through the AGCO. It's what I find most interesting about her. You know, I had Higher Limits Cannabis Lounge downtown. Obviously, she was opposed to that, opposed to cannabis retail, opposed to legalization, and now opposed to legal consumption of cannabis. I ask the question, she says there's secondhand smoke concerns for something that's going to be outdoors. If you're not experiencing this problem right now, well after legalization, trust me, it's not going to become that big of a deal if it's in a confined space outdoors. I find it, though, really gross. We have seen more jobs develop in the cannabis industry locally, just in retail alone, than most other sectors can boast for in such a short period of time. And that's what, you know, supposedly her and a bunch of her types on the council block are for, is that kind of economic development, is that kind of more jobs. So I find this whole clutching pearls debate about cannabis and legalization to just be so tiring here. What a waste for administration to come back and say there's nothing that we can do about a patio that people are standing on. The AGCO sets this licensing. It's not a patio that serves food or drink, so we can't limit the combustion or vaporization through the Smoke-Free Ontario Act. Just get a grip. It's legal. It's here. People are going to be doing this. It comes down to, would you rather have people drinking a bunch of alcohol wherever they are in the streets and, you know, getting into that? Or do you want, you know, what a bar is, a restaurant, a supervised consumption site where, you know, it's done responsibly and in a way that it's licensed, where, you know, the buck does stop with someone. So for your consideration, get over it. Weed's legal.
You know, I know that this is for your consideration. We're not supposed to comment, but I have to comment, and then we'll leave it at that. This, you know, reminds me of a couple of other recent media items featuring Joanne Geniac. There was the helicopters, the tour helicopters flying over Riverside, and she was, incensed about that and raised the issue. I gotta say, there's a pattern here where Councillor Geniac is by, to my eye, going for the cynical media hit. This is grabbing for the low-hanging fruit to get herself a little bit of exposure in the media. This is, you know, how is this serving residents? How is this making Windsor a better city? You know, Councillor Geniac, it's so disappointing because Councillor Geniac is one of the smartest councillors around that table. She's one of the most experienced councillors around that table. And what she's choosing to do is lazy and cynical and disappointing.
You know, some might argue that what she's doing right now is an exercise in legacy building. And I wonder how much longer she's either going to be remaining on council or if she has any other plans for stepping up. I mean, we're going after the same old drum here, beating on the cannabis train, as you said, making noise about helicopter noise. And then the most recent one, I mean, voting against housing for the streetcar after voting blindly for funding of the streetcar. It's like, what's going on here? It's like, so there's either, you know, spite that's going on or ulterior motives, or she's just getting out and doesn't care anymore. And I don't know, I'm kind of feeling like that might be what's at play here. It's a very different council. And what kind of a role is someone like her going to play? And do you want to do that for another 4 years, knowing that you're probably going to be on the wrong side of a losing battle more often than not, for your consideration? That's it. That's the show. We did it. We got through from the top all the way to the end. Had a little bit there in the middle too. It was pretty good all around. Tonight we had on Jessica Macaset-Bondi and Julian Villafuerte, two of the founders of five founders of Active Transit Windsor Essex, a new transit advocacy group seeking for the use and advancement of an interconnected transit system in Windsor Essex. My name is John Lidke. I had Doug Sartori here coming live from the Magic School bus tonight. Did Miss Frizzle ever make it? Are you in a blood cell? I don't know.
Could be. Maybe that's where we're headed next.
Could be, maybe. Thank you if you've been tuning in. This has been a really fun transit-centric episode of Rose City Politics, Windsor's only municipal politics podcast. Please do support us at patreon.com/Rose City Politics. Be sure to check us out in BizX Magazine at bizxmagazine.com, on all of your favorite social media and podcasting apps. And it is November 3rd, and Rose City Politics has been able to broadcast live on tape thanks to the kind support of Leuna 625, Building Better Communities. We will be back next week.